Hello, and welcome to the College Crosscast, a lacrosse news, analysis, and commentary podcast. My name is Saif Fakadu, and I'm one of your co-hosts for the show today. On the other line is my co-host, Jake Nazar. Jake, how you doing, man?
What's happening?
Loving this Thursday night, you know, the little ACC lacrosse action. Got to preview the weekend with you. I think you're all vaxxed up, right? I had my first shot since we last talked, which is I'm very happy. I just got to go to the Cure Arena across the street from me. So, on my way to number two. So, you'd love to see it. We love to say it.
We do love to see it.
Absolutely. So, actually got a nice little weekend of games. Starting, obviously, with Thursday night, but got a little, you know, decent slate, at least the Friday night games as well. We'll preview those after we do our introspective looks at the major games. So, now, first off, we're going to start with Jake, as you aptly put it, the one of the most lopsided yet competitive series in all of college lacrosse.
It's not competitive.
well stated. There have been several like 17-3 blowouts, but there have been some, you know, pretty close games that at least going to the Sarja era. But I don't know if you want to elaborate for the audience, but that run Duke has had over pretty much almost 20 years has been quite impressive.
Yeah, so Duke tweeted it out on their page, which is truly, talk about just a low-key flex. Just like, how do we quietly just dunk on one of our rivals in the most low-key way possible? Duke has beaten Virginia 18 times since 2007.
Yeah, 18-2.
Virginia's beaten them twice. If we go back to 2005, mind you, that was the year Virginia made the Final Four. Duke beat them that year 17-2. Mm. So it's 19 of the last 21 games to Duke in this series. And there are... Yeah, the reason I said not competitive is because there are some wild scores in here. 2000, and wild scores over like good Virginia teams, great Virginia teams, even. That's what makes what I mean. The numbers themselves. The fact that Duke's beaten Virginia, Duke went almost a decade without losing to Virginia, and if not for Laviano scoring a goal right at the end in that semifinal, they would have done it. So. In 2008, Duke beat Virginia 19-9 in the regular season. That was a Virginia team that made the Final Four that year. Duke beat them by 10 goals in Charlottesville in the regular season. In 2009, Duke beat Virginia 15-10 and 16-5 by a combined 16 goals in two games. That was a Virginia team that went to the Final Four. 2010, Duke beat Virginia. That was the one of the years actually Virginia beat Duke. Was 2010, they beat them in the ACC semifinals. Duke, of course, would go on to beat Virginia in the national semifinals that year for Duke to go on to win the national championship. So even in a year, that was the first year Virginia beat them in 6 years, and still Duke would beat them in the national semifinals a year. 2011, the year Virginia won the national championship, Duke beat them 19-10 in the ACC tournament. And then from there, you get into some not as good Virginia teams. But there's some, like, absolute blowouts in here. Over Final Four Virginia teams. Even in 2019, the only team Virginia lost to in their last, like, 15 or 16 games was Duke by 5 goals. Before that time, Virginia was able to flip the script and beat Duke in the NCAA tournament. But yeah, this is the most shockingly lopsided rivalry in college lacrosse. I mean, it's not even, like, it's just, there's not, even it's, like, Division I men's sports. I have no, like, other frame of reference to compare this to in terms of just how unbelievable it is that they've beaten them this many times. I mean, it's truly nuts. It gets to the point now. I can't pick Virginia to beat Duke. I just physically can't do it. As for this game, beside the analysis of, well, of course Duke's going to win because Duke always beats Virginia. It's an interesting one. You've got the two, I don't know if they're the ACC's got quite a few, but by about three elite faceoff guys in Duke's Drake Naso, Virginia's Petey LaSala, and Notre Dame's Kyle Gallagher, and then I guess Charlie Leonard as well.
Yeah, double headed monster though.
But Jake Naso dominated Notre Dame. So I think, and I believe LaSala got slightly the edge on Notre Dame. I can't recall on Notre Dame's too, but I think it was 50-50 one way or the other there. I think Naso is one of the first two draws here in this one. So I think Jake Naso is, I think, the best faceoff guy in the ACC. And then I think it's LaSala and you've got the Notre Dame guys there. So that's going to play a role. It's 1-1, by the way, right now as we're recording. Duke struck first, and then Virginia answered. Mike Adler just made a save on Matt Moore. So I think that plays a role. Duke won a bunch of the faceoffs against Notre Dame, but they just blew it away through bad clearing. As I speak, right on cue, Duke just blew another clear. Their first one of this game, but Virginia just rode back, got an extra possession. So that's obviously going to be an intriguing factor in this game. Virginia's got routinely one of the best rides in the country. Duke's clearing has been good all year, but just very bad against Notre Dame. Virginia's clear itself has not been particularly great this year. The main thing I come back to, I feel like, is the way to beat Duke, kind of as we talked about on Sunday, if you want to go back and listen to that show, on how you match up and stop Duke's offense. I don't know if I can see Virginia replicating that. I don't think they have a guy who can stick on Michael Sowers. We kind of saw that with Duke's first goal, where Sowers was able to break his man down. He drew a slide, he fed off, and then he got a hockey assist on it. He fed off another pass inside, and that was Duke's first goal. So Duke's first goal was really, there's a bulldog to the cage by Charlie Bertrand, I believe, and Virginia just takes a 2-1 lead. But that's why I picked Duke. I just think, I don't know if Virginia, and defensively we've spoken plenty about their struggles, but I just don't know if they can match up the way that Notre Dame so effectively did and the way that North Carolina did. I think they're probably going to put Sostad on Sowers, and Sostad's, you know, kind of a rangy guy. He can do well against bigger attackmen, but I don't know if he can do as well against a smaller, shifty, quick guy the way Sowers is. And if you can't stop Sowers, well, then as we saw when Duke played Syracuse a couple Thursdays ago, everything's just going to come easy to Duke's offense, and it's all going to work the way they want it to. If you can stick to him and you can make him a dodger and not a feeder, well, then the way they kind of clog the middle up with him, they like to dodge from the midfield down. I think that that's what makes the most effective. Notre Dame clearly did it. Carolina didn't have a great defense, but I think they had better matchups in certain places to match up against Duke. I don't know if Virginia has that, so that's why I'm going with Duke. However, if Virginia is either able to win some of these faceoffs, or if they're able to, I mean, so far they scored three goals in like four possessions. If they're able to keep executing like this on offense so far, then we're going to be in for probably a shootout, and who knows when you get a shootout.
Your point about the failed clears is very accurate, because against the other ACC opponents, they had like four failed clears against Cuse, I believe another four against North Carolina, but it was just disastrous. 21 of 29 against Notre Dame, that helped like just short circuit that offense. Essentially, Duke only had like 20 shots on goal all game, 36 total, you know. And if maybe a team from the state of Virginia that's known for their clears can get the same type of results, we may have another kind of adventurous night in the ACC. So definitely going to be interesting to keep our eyes on that. I don't know if you had any other points before we move on to next games, or just...
No, I think, yes, I think that's the big story, is Duke's clearing, how that works itself out. If Virginia can get more possessions through that or through the faceoffs with LaSala, obviously, then I think they are going to be able to turn this into a they're going to be able to keep pace in an offensive game like this. I think if – and so far they have. They're outpacing Duke at the moment. Duke's had – about two possessions of Virginia's four, even though Duke's won two of the three faceoffs. So that's where a fail clear comes into play. If, though, Duke can cut down on the clears and have them replicate the faceoff success they've had in these ACC games so far, I think I would lean towards the Blue Devils, but I think that's where the matchup comes into play. I don't know if either defense has, like, even though Duke's defense has been good this year, very good, often at times, it's still the way Virginia's offense is playing. That's still a very hard task to defend. It's still hard to expect to get a lot of stops when you're playing an offense of that caliber.
Yeah, they just keep coming at you, and if you continue to fail to clear, and well, maybe we have to put a hashtag clear watch. Duke's already 0-2, and they're down 3-1 to the Cavs. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting then in Carolina. In Virginia. So, moving on to one of the other big games that we're going to be interested in. We'll talk about the Friday stuff after the big games. But Georgetown get the chance to avenge their early season loss to Denver. The Pios are coming up to come across country to Cooper Field. The first go around, the Denver Pios won 13-7. as we joke around, there's no excuses in college lacrosse and no more victories. So even though we try to sprinkle a few, given the fact that Georgetown flew in the day of the game, it seems like pretty early, and a makeup game after it was canceled on the weekend. So, you know, definitely a big opportunity for Hoyas. Like, pretty much, you know, if they want to kind of keep an at-large possibility alive, this is a must-win game for that. There's still probably one of the top two teams in the Big East, so they'll be a threat to win the AQ. But, you know, getting a win against BT and Denver, which I think top three in some polls or number two in ours. I know you broke it down by the numbers, but this is an opportunity, you know, especially when you're playing like these kind of mostly conference-only games. Saw with Rutgers wasn't able to capitalize, but if you have a chance to, you know, get a win against the arguably, you know, top five, maybe final four team, yeah, you gotta capitalize on it. So it's gonna be interesting for, you know, with Hoyas, they seem to be getting a little bit healthier. That defense is starting to replicate what we've seen in the earlier year, and that offense though really woke up against St. John's last weekend, two weekends ago, 27. And then it closed, you know, it's Marquette's tough team. You know, they're kind of tough the first go around. Marquette, lost 2013, but by that point, they were the first team to even get double digits. They scored more than the previous three teams combined. The Golden Eagles fell short 10-8. So Georgetown's looking good. Offense seems to be coming back alive. This is kind of what we're hoping for, you know. Relatively healthy, both teams playing on a regular weekend game. You know, it's not canceled and making some makeshift game in the middle of the week. Denver looks good, though. And the offense seems to be coming around. Obviously, they have a very dynamic face-off tandem. So, love your thoughts.
Yeah, Denver dominated this game the first go-around. They... won all the matchups on the offensive side of the ball, and defensively they really dominated the Hoyas. They gave them fits in the ten man ride. Georgetown just had no answer for it whatsoever from the beginning. They were pretty spooked, and they were just trying to shoot on the empty net, which to not a lot of success. They got jumped, Georgetown, pretty much early, kind of in that second quarter, and they never really were able to respond. I expect this will be a much, much closer game. Georgetown has Gibson Smith back. They have Dylan Watson back on the offensive side of the ball. They're going to be fine on defense, I think. Denver in the first game operated at 46.4% adjusted offensive efficiency. I can't see that happening this time. What happened really was kind of what when we previewed it, we said, as good as Georgetown's defense has been playing, with no Gibson Smith, someone is going to get a matchup against some of those middies that they're not going to like. And Jack Hanna just completely feasted on probably... Normally, this go-around, Jack Hanna is going to get matched up on... I'd figure honestly, they might put Gibson Smith on him. I wouldn't rule it out, but they'll probably put Gibby Smith on Jackson Moral. That's probably will be where they're going to go with it. This time around, he's probably going to get Hannah, who got either a long pull or a fourth defender in the first matchup. Now he's going to get one of Georgetown's top three defenders, probably either James Donaldson or Will Tominovich, either one. Young guys, Tominovich is a freshman, but he was a five-star. Donaldson's a sophomore, so 1.5 seasons in. He is both guys were five. Both got Donaldson's a five-star as well. They're both supremely talented guys, as we've seen by the fact that Georgetown's been the number one defense in the country pretty much all year long. So now that you get Hannah on a poll that Georgetown likes, one of those two guys. You put, I imagine, Gibby Smith on Jackson Morrill. You put one on Ethan Walker. Maybe you put Alex Mazzone long pole on Walker, because Walker's more of a shooter, not as much of a threat to dodge, albeit he can do it. Then you're going to get the rest of those midfielders. You're going to get a second. You're going to get a long pole in Mazzone against maybe Lucas Kotler or Ted Sullivan, and it all just balances itself out much more nicely. Hannah dominated the first game. He feasted. He had 4 goals. That was the difference in what he, because he got a match he was more comfortable with. And then you had Kotler had a goal and an assist. Ted Sullivan had a goal. Even a short stick committee, Danny Logan, had a goal. Denver just really cunted the matchups they wanted because of the injuries and took advantage of it. This time around, it's going to be a lot more beneficial for Georgetown. So I expect that Georgetown will be fine on defense. I think they're going to hold Denver probably somewhere in the range of 10 to 11 is what I'd imagine. My question is the offense. Georgetown is not a good shooting team. That's their issue. Jake Caraway is a great shooter, especially as an outside shooter, and he's one of the best players in the country. That's kind of it. Watson can shoot. He stretch it a little bit. He's also more of an inside guy, so he can improve that to some degree. But as we saw against Marquette, I think they shot around 23% in that game. And they still wasn't all that great of a offensive game against Marquette. This has just kind of been their problem all year long. It was their problem against Denver, too, where they created a lot of good looks. They just could not can any of them. And they have had these issues pretty much all. I mean, against Denver, they operated at 25% offensive efficiency. Against Providence, they perked up to 32%, which is not bad. It's not great. Against Villanova, they were at 20%, not good. St. John's, they were awesome at 39%. And Marquette, they dropped down to 25%. They can drop a bad offensive game just as often as they can drop a good one. And it's not because they don't have talented guys. Caraway obviously is awesome. TJ Haley's a fantastic passer. He's got 4 goals and 37 assists. He's a great passer. Grant Bundy Jr. is going to be a All-American midfielder if he isn't already. He's a terrific player. Nikki Pekovic can dodge and pass as well. Watson is the one thing Watson does, even if he isn't going to help necessarily the outside shooting, which I believe he can, but mostly he's going to give them a real crease guy as well. He can operate in there and finish, and that at least gives them another option. They can try and go inside because they'll know he's got good hands. It's kind of similar to this, the role, you know, Maryland can do with Daniel Maltz. You know, they don't have to necessarily take as many bad shots because they can go, we got a guy inside too. We can finish in there. And so it presents them a plan B if their shots aren't falling, which they didn't have in the first game. They just kept taking shots and they kept missing them. And they weren't bad shots. Like, they got good looks. They couldn't hit any of them. The issue, though, is you got to hit your... If James Riley's a really great face-off guy, and I don't think this is going to be a truly lopsided game in terms of face-offs, but... You know, if it is 60-40, if Denver is giving them problems on the 10-man ride again, you're going to need to hit some shots, you know? Like, you're just going to need to hit some outside looks, and that's my worry. That's really where I worry from. I don't have that worry with Denver. I know that they can do it with Walker, with Hannah, and some of their other guys, and I love Georgetown's defense. It's, if not the best defense in the country, it's at worst like two or three. It's a phenomenal defense. They've got a great goalie. They're always going to be in games because of that defense. But I just don't know if they have the offense because of the lack of shooters. And that's kind of my worry in this one, is if they get, you know, behind in terms of the possessions, and if Denver's able to rack them up, it's hard to kind of run your offense and just, you know, just say, all right, we're just going to keep it. Just do what we do. Get it inside to Watson. Find some matchups for Caraway. That's another thing they'll be interested to see if they do. They really didn't hunt matchups for Caraway in the first game. He was very – I mean, in the second half, they kind of got it to him more. But by that point, it was too little too late. Do you get in a point where, you know, you're just like – you start dodging, you start taking shots, and if they don't fall – can you get in a hole? I don't think they'll get in a big hole. I think this will be a close competitive game throughout, and I think it'll be much competitive, and I believe the Hoyas will certainly be in there with a chance to win, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if they did come away with a win. If their shots do fall, then they're going to score goals because they can dodge past you, they can pass the ball and move the ball really well. If their shots fall, they can beat anybody. But if they don't, that's my worry. I don't quite have that same worry with Denver. And so that's like, these are two interesting teams. You know, you've got Denver, who's a top 10 offense and a solid defense, just a shade inside the top 20. Then you got Georgetown, who's a elite defense, the best in the country in adjusted defensive efficiency. And then, you know, it's just a shade inside the top 20 offense. And then you've got both teams are not too dissimilar in faceoffs either. Denver's 5th, Georgetown's 11th. So they're kind of similar, just in opposite ways. So that's what makes these games interesting. And we'll see what happens. It's certainly, I expect just a much better effort from Georgetown than we got the first time around, and I expect it'll go down to the wire. But I don't know. Earlier in the year, I definitely, you know, I picked the Hoyas the first go around. Earlier in the year, I expected the Hoyas to be the best team. I'm not as sure of that anymore, albeit I don't think it's a big gap between these teams at all.
I mean, just looking at Haley's line for the last three games, it's pretty incredible. And literally, only three shots in the last three games. His last shot was in the Villanova game, which was two games ago. The one goal, 13 assists, and literally three shots. So that one that he did score on that was in the Villanova game. So it would be interesting if he, you know, maybe teams play off of him, expecting him to just be more passer, if he a little aggressive, maybe one or two goals, you know. Because if that four, that, I mean, not to be cliche, but if that core four, you know, Jake, Watson, TJ, and Bundy, if they get a little cooking and then you just get whatever contributions you can from, you know, what we've been talking about with Rutgers, you know, their four gets – have a really good game. That's when, like, Knobloch and other players just step up, and that's just, you know, extra gravy. So I agree with you. I think it's going to be a closer game. Maybe that's wishful thinking, because Denver really has been, you know, pretty impressive pretty much since that Georgetown game. You and I have just really taken notice. Like, they've, you know, we've kind of complimented them on their poise and their ability to, you know, just always seem to be in control. And now with a, you know, kind of a dynamic face-off team, face-off tandem, and their offense clicking. Yeah, they're going to be a player, and this is like what we say. You know, this is why the kids come to these schools for these big games. So, big opportunity for Georgetown this weekend.
I'll make one more point that is potentially interesting. The last two times these teams have played twice, the second meeting, Denver has won in 2018 and 2019. Denver won the first meeting on both occasions. 2018, they won in at Cooper Field in D.C. They beat them 6-5. 2019, they played at Denver, and Denver blew Georgetown out 16-9 in that one. Both times they came back around and played a second time, Georgetown won both meetings. And they looked – the first one, they absolutely – the 2018, they held Denver to three goals and, I mean, really got on. 2019, they won by 12-9. difference, both of those second meetings were the Big East championship games, so they were playing at the end of the year. Well, this time they're still kind of in the middle of their seasons. They're playing this meeting now, their second meeting, not about a couple weeks after they would have normally played their first meeting. These two teams normally play the last week of March for their regular season meeting. This time they played their first regular season game March 16th, so like 2 weeks before normally. And now they're playing their second meeting about a 2 weeks or 3 weeks rather earlier than they normally would. They could play again, and probably will play again. I'd be surprised if they didn't, in 3 weeks in the Big East championship game. But is just interesting and worth noting that Denver, the second go around in the last couple of years, has really, they've looked much, or Georgetown rather, in the second go around, have looked much improved from the first mm-hmm. game. And they have won those two games relatively easily. I don't expect it to happen this time, but this is Bill Tierney, the best coach there's ever been, and so at least in the men's game. And so it is often surprising when you see a coach or a coaching staff kind of get his number a second go around, and with, you know, another more to scout and more to game plan for him to make those adjustments. Georgetown and Kevin Warren have made those adjustments in those second games.
Oh, absolutely. Moving on to a team that I think a really interesting matchup. I mean, we've been saying it's been kind of a fascinating turn of events lately, especially in the ACC, where, you know, well, honestly, Notre Dame, who we've always had faith in, is now showing that, and Virginia has kind of turned it around and kind of the teams that were at the top. I don't want to say slipping too much, but you know, they did get caught last weekend against Notre Dame. But Carolina, you know, still imposing. I made that joke that I don't want to jump off the bandwagon because they remind me of those Maryland teams the last few years where their only losses were like one or two or an overtime or something like that. So the Heels are, you know, 8-2 on the season. Kind of weird to say they're 1-2 in the ACC. Lost to Duke, that memorable overtime game two Thursdays ago that me and Ryan were on together watching and talking. And then last weekend, kind of got, in the shootout, just, the Virginia had a couple more slugs, dominant face-off performance in the fourth quarter by the Cavs helped to, hold off Carolina in the 18-16 victory for UVA. And now, the Heels are traveling up to Syracuse, who, in their own right, also kind of interesting situation. The Orange are 5-3. They, too, are 1-2 in the ACC. They are, 1-2 in their last two games, lost to Duke in kind of a thrilling 15-14 game, really interesting down at Carolina. And they lost to Notre Dame and kind of not even close. Blowout 18-11 at home. And then, this last Thursday, they bounced back with a 13-8 victory over Albany. So, we got two teams, I just think you probably were with me, like they're very confident in Carolina's offense. That defense does give us some pause. They still look like a pretty good team. Syracuse, they kind of up and down, they had that, dominant winner against UVA, which looks better and better as weeks go by. Coming off of, close loss to Duke, but, it's still a loss. And then, that blowout to Notre Dame, it's going to be interesting how they kind of respond in this weekend's game against Carolina, especially, if the Heels bring that offense that we're expecting. A lot of interesting matchups here. I think we've talked at length about Carolina's midfield and how potent that offense is, especially with our boy Chris Gray. I think if they have I don't want to always kind of be a broken record and go back to face off, but as long as they don't have like a disastrous day and Fob just kills them, I think they should be able to stay at that 40% clip for adjusted offensive efficiency. If they get like 40 shots as they usually get, they should be able to get around that 15, 16 goals. And I would be interested to see if, Syracuse can keep up with that offense. Cause what we saw, especially with that Duke game, 2 weekends ago, like that first quarter, but for Adler, like Carolina may gotten out of that first quarter with like a 7-2 lead or something. So, you know, if they can just connect more on those shots and kind of get up there really early, that could be a long day for Syracuse. And do you think you and I both picked Carolina? Did anyone pick Syracuse in our pick them? I think
maybe. You picked Hughes.
Oh, I did. this is like the pick them times where you got to like go for the ones that I'm going to with that. Who's the internet personality you guys always saw?
The Jason Kirk rule is we never leave ourselves vulnerable by all picking the same team. Adam also picked Hughes.
I'd say I just kind of went on length about North Carolina, but I kind of feel like I want to say must win game for Syracuse. You know, everyone can do the math. You know, they do need to win their last three to not be in an awkward position coming Selection Sunday. So, I mean, I think that and the Jason Kirk rule is why I went with Carolina. But yeah, I'm still not, Syracuse, I'm still not like abandoning North Carolina. But, it would be an opportunity for Syracuse, you know, to kind of write their ship and stuff. Sorry to kind of hog the mic there.
No problem. I think this one is the thing with Carolina they've got stuck in the rut that. And we get to this point of the season, I think for the last 3 or 4 years, this is kind of where this is kind of one of my cliches or kind of hobby horses that I kind of, you know, bang on. They're getting to that point where I hate to see is when you do one thing really well one week and then you do one thing really well the other, but then you flip what you did bad, you know, like against Duke, they actually played okay on offense against, Blue Devils. Their adjusted offensive efficiency was 34.4%, but they played great defense. They came back a week later against Virginia, and they had a Carolina offensive game. Wasn't quite as good as the first one against Virginia, where their offensive efficiency adusted was over 50%, which is just gross. But they were still at 43. They were above their season average. They had a monster offensive game. They were bad on defense. Yes, I know that they... Petey LaSala won all those faceoffs in that, fourth quarter. And that played a big role, certainly. But still, they weren't good on... And that's kind of where I don't like to see that, you know? That worries me is when you have a... And some of these are kind of margins. Again, they weren't bad on offense against Duke, but they were pretty well below their... You know, like their only worst games on offense were against High Point, that game that was like a Tinder date way back in... February, I think, and then they had one against Mercer where they weren't great either. But for all intents and purposes, you know, they were about 8% below their season average. Certainly, you expect to be below it when you play a tougher opponent. You know, that's part of the name of the game of playing tougher opponents is, you know, the difficulty gets ratcheted up, certainly, but still, they weren't Carolina on offense. I think in just regular offensive efficiency, just the percentage of – they were 27% of just regular efficiency. That's just – they scored on 27% of their possessions. Adjusted raises it because they played a really good defense. But still, in terms of just regular offensive efficiency, that was by far Carolina's worst game of the year. They were 8% lower than the other game they played. But they played their best defensive game. I didn't think they could play a defensive game that well. They played awesome. And then you hoped, like, hey, you know, yeah, you lost that game. But I know a lot of people coming out of that thought, man, Carolina kind of looked like the better team. I feel like maybe they let one get away. Then you go to Virginia, and you just can't get stops. And so that worries me in terms of how are they going, you know, long-term, where the direction of this team is going. That worries me, is when you get into kind of those you know, where something's letting you down every week, where something, you know, is preventing you from playing at your best. And I don't know if that's what you want as the calendar turns to April and now as we get it closer going to May. So that worries me a bit with Carolina. As for the matchup itself, I don't think Jacob Faulp has had some rough games in ACC play in terms of the face-offs. I think this one will probably Carolina obviously got dominated by PLSI last week. These are probably the bottom two teams in terms of faceoffs in the ACC. I think it'll probably work its way out fairly even. I don't know if that'll be the big factor. I expect Carolina to have a big day offense on offense. Syracuse's defense has come around a bit in terms of defensive efficiency. They're up to 20th in the country. So they're improved. They've gotten a bit better. But in these big games, you kind of know what you're... I mean, it's Army, 38% defensive efficiency. Notre Dame, 36%. Duke was only 25%. But they lost the matchups in that game. I mean, Sauer's really won dominate his. That was Michael Sauer's best game of the year. They tend to, aside from the Virginia game, really, they tend to play good defense against teams who you expect them to beat, and not great defense against teams who either you, pardon me, expect them to lose to. Or, again, games against, you know, ACC opponents, Virginia, Army, you know, these similar talent schools. They're, you know, kind of these big games. So I expect that North Carolina is going to score. I just don't see Cuse having, I just don't think they have the guys on defense. I think Mitch Wyckoff's a solid player. I don't think he couldn't match up really well with Michael Sauers. I can't see him. Maybe he can match up a bit better on Gray. Gray isn't as much of a, you know, shifty guy the way Sauers is. But if the thing with Gray is that even if you push Gray away from goal line extended, even if you try and push him out to the wing, he can still hurt you with his shooting a lot. He's so multifaceted and multidimensional in the ways he can hurt you. So I can't really see that matchup going well for them. And then from there, the thing with Cuse that's really hurt them is kind of off ball, the communication. That's not what you want against the Carolina offense. Carolina offense is a Dave Metzbauer coached offense. When his offenses are humming and they're at their best, the ball moves just so fast that if you are not communicating well and you're not, your guys' eyes aren't in the right place off ball, you're just going to get shredded. It's a nightmare if you are not on your game in terms of your off-ball defense and your communication and your slides. Because Metzbauer offenses, this is true going back to when he was at Princeton with Bill Tierney, and now it's true at Carolina when he's, you know, at a much faster pace and a much different, bit of a different kind of style. That's just not what you want. And you cannot have breakdowns in terms of your communication against the Mets offense. So I don't like the matchup for Cuse on the defensive side. And then you also get into, you talked about that midfield. If you put a pole on Gray, your best guy, then you put a pole on Solomon, then you got to put two on Perry and Cook. Well, then you got a shorty, maybe Justin Anderson. I don't know if I trust Cuse's shorties in some of these matchups against Carolina's guys. That's not. And then if Carolina is able to get a matchup they really want to get, a Cook or a Gray on a shorty, I don't see that going well. Peter Durst, great, but beyond that, I'm not a fan of Cuse's shorty depth the way some other people are. Cuse should be able to score too. I don't doubt that they'll be able to score as well. It's just that the difference between these teams on offense, Carolina's about 4% more efficient in terms of the defense. Syracuse is about 2.8% more efficient. So there's a bit of a bigger gap between Carolina and Cuse's offense and Cuse and Carolina's defenses. And then I just think in terms of the offense, I think Carolina's just deeper. They're deeper than really kind of everybody. But I think they're probably a bit deeper than Cuse's. Trimboli hasn't quite come on this year. I don't know what's been going on, but he's always the guy we've seen as kind of the best guy on that defense. The best guy on that midfield. Hadn't quite been the case this year. 9 points in around 7-8 games for him. So I don't know. Tucker Dordovic's been a bit more quiet in some of these ACC games compared to what he would had the big game against Army Virginia at the beginning of the year. So I favor Carolina, but it is a bit disconcerting to me, kind of I wanted to see them carry some of that defense over from that Duke to the Virginia game and then match it with a better offensive effort, and it didn't happen. And so the trend line with them is a bit worrying. I'm not saying it's, you know, it's not catastrophic or anything, not fatal, but it's, you know, still just a bit, I don't know. It has raised my eyebrow a bit. And if they were to lose this one, then yeah, we'd definitely be, you know, that definitely get both eyebrows raised.
Such a rocky year at the Dome for Syracuse. That disaster against Army, obviously, that was at home. Turn around, just double up Virginia 20-10. Fault just had a great game. Then lose, like, you know, in a really kind of competitive game against the Irish back on April 3rd. That was, you know, also at home. So I do wonder, you know, we love the intricacies, like, is Carolina traveling the day up? That would be something to know. What time is the game at?
I believe 3 p.m. so. I think every ACC team is traveling.
So
road games, or at least they don't get many like overnight bus trips this year because of COVID. Yeah. If they do get one, it's only a few. Which maybe this will be one because it's a long trip. This might be, I think this is probably Carolina's longest trip of the year.
I was just going to say, like,
do they play they do play Notre Dame on the road, so that'd be longer. But that'd be a plane probably. So
that's what's it, like, 3 hour plane? I mean, just doing, Ryan was here. This is the one time I wish Ryan was here for that specific. You know, it's like,
oh, a yeah, deep Ryan, knowledge. Ryan's big time on the geography.
Exactly. But it's going to be a flying. So we're thinking 3 p.m. start. That's actually a little bit, you know, give you a little bit of a cushion instead of like a 12 p.m., you know, nooner type of game if you're flying out in the morning. This also be a little interesting. This is, like I said, I kind of feel like this is where I kind of went with juice. It's kind of all or nothing. Right, that all or nothing. Aren't people like? But if you lose that one, like, it's, you know, then you're at Virginia and then at Notre Dame to end the season. If you don't make a makeup game for the end of the year, so this is a big game. This last home game, you know, we always joke around about home field advantage in Syracuse. So they're going to need all of it this weekend for our boy Chris and Coach Joe Bresci. Moving on, Jake, you know, as we always say, one for them, one for us. This is definitely one for me. We're not going to dwell on, bad Hopkins team, but, you know, the Jays are traveling to Jersey. You know, I love that. You know, it's nightmarish. When they play Rutgers, it has been fun, especially Rutgers fans getting angry about, like, you know, goals that shouldn't have counted maybe. But, you know, when Hopkins has traveled Jersey in the past, especially to play Princeton, has been disastrous. Looking forward to this one. I think confirm that our boy Adam is coming through. So we'll both be at SHI. It's going to be a big game for Rutgers fans. Senior day. And I believe it's also a celebration of alumni. The game will also be the annual Alumni Appreciation Day, as Rutgers will pay tribute to those who have made many contributions to the program today. I joked around with you, when I saw the Terps there, that SHI is a fun place to be. Very, very lively crowd. There's going to be the weather, not too chilly, 5 o'clock start, but it should be a fun day. Looking at the two squads, obviously, Rutgers, between you and I, no disrespect, obviously, to this, never a big fan of the NASCAR label. If we're just going to label, we just call it something with New Jersey Turnpike, because, you know, cars fly up and down that that highway. I think we could do a little better than NASCAR. Just don't associate NASCAR in Jersey. Rutgers looks good. Offensively, just had an explosion last weekend against Penn State. I think that, you know, Brecht is kind of knows is a little bit of the eye test, as we've been saying all year long. So winning is important, but, you know, kind of having these convincing, even though Penn State's had a little bit of trouble this year, so, you know, impressive you know, score, if you see, and you know, we were watching the game, seemed like records were scoring every time you turn it back onto Big Ten Network. Hopkins, offensively, was a little happy to see what they did against Ohio State. This, you know, after you know, two kind of just dismal weekends of offensive efficiency. Still just weird. We're almost, you know, at the last home stretch of the season. Kind of still don't really feel like this team has a kind of an, you know, an identity. I mean, besides like just being blah, you know, 28th in adjusted offensive efficiency and 29.1% in adjusted defensive efficiency. Faceoff is just adjusted faceoff efficiency is just 52.5%. So really just a, you know, this is a meh results so far this year. Sometimes we had some glimpses of competitive play, you know, that one half against Maryland, you know, nice offensive game against Penn State, but that all kind of feels distant to go, especially right now in a four-game losing streak. Like I said, I don't want to talk too much about this game. Doesn't have too much import before the Big Ten tournament starts. But you know, if you had a couple thoughts you wanted to share with the people,
no,
definitive. I like it. Let's go to our next one. Like I said, that one's one for me. So how do you throw that out there? See me out there in New Brunswick this weekend. The mighty, mighty Terrapins, Jake. just keep rolling. They will be what time is this game? 5 o'clock as well, right?
Sunday
at 5, but yeah, like a 5 o'clock game at home versus Ohio State. You know, we always love seeing the Buckeyes play the Terrapins. The first go around was definitely not comparative. Maryland won in a convincing 16-8 fashion. The Terps, you know, got popped in the mouth, as you pointed out last week against Michigan, you know, kind of going down 5-0 and then responded, you know, thoroughly by going on a 16-0 run. That offense is still, you know, just pouring in goals. We got an audience question that we'll get to at the end. It's kind of ties into Maryland's offense. But, you know, besides the 13-9 game against Rutgers, Maryland has not played anybody closer to, I think, 5 victories. They got a 6-point against Penn State the first go around. And I think that's the next closest one.
Only one game fewer than 6 goals this year.
Yeah, 2 6-point kind of Michigan game and then the first Penn State game, which was, you know, first Penn State game was arguably one of the worst halves we've ever seen with Maryland.
Not great.
Definitely right of the ship. You know, let's just see. Our boy JB is getting a little bit more national acclaim. I think it was the offensive player of the week for Big Ten again. You know, just playing, elbowing his way into the top two for like Tuaratan. You know, I think Chris Grace is the only other guy right now, but if JB keeps, Jared Bernhardt keeps playing this way, it's going to be really tough to not give him the war time, especially in Maryland, you know, just continues being a dominant. I did pick the Ohio State Buckeyes in this one again, the Jason Kirk rule, but I do feel like a little sneaky. I think we said this, right? Like when Ohio State plays Maryland, like they do save, you know, their most antagonistic play for the Terrapins. And they catch the Terps' nap. And so, I mean, Maryland's, you know, been the dominant team. No disrespect to Mr. Tillman. You know, there's, I think it was 3 years ago, the 2018 game. I don't have the preview up on either site, but Ohio State, you know, knocked off the number one Terrapins. And while Maryland, you know, thoroughly won the first go around this year, I think, yeah, maybe Ohio State's feeling a little something. You know, that offense did look really good against, or, you know, better than they had been prior against Hopkins last week. And you know, if there's a team that could annoy Maryland into their first loss of the season, I could see, you know, Ohio State doing it. So that's why I went with the Buckeyes. Yeah, definitely think Maryland's still class of the nation, but yeah, I think this, you know, with the Hopkins end of the year game, 1 week ahead, like, you know, potentially maybe see, not them looking ahead, but like this could be a game that the Terps get caught napping.
I don't think that's going to happen after last week. I think that was probably a well-timed, wake-up call a bit for Maryland. Ohio State, they can get in. These two teams don't like each other. That's certainly true, albeit it's been a bit more quiet in recent years. Those 2017 and 2018 groups, they played each other like four times in a year. familiarity breeds contempt.
Absolutely.
So yeah, those teams played each other a lot. By the time they'd come back around 2018, Ohio State was desperate. It is a similar situation in terms of the desperation Ohio State has. They're not quite there yet, but similar to 2018, an Ohio State team that, you know, had a lot of preseason hype and expectation, that didn't get off to a good start, that kind of found itself a bit more later in the season, that was then, you know, traveling to College Park, number one team in the country, and needed a big win. And Ohio State does need a big win. Listen, if Ohio State wins this game, I don't think they will, but the tenor of the bubble conversation flips on its head. Because there is no better win in the country than a Maryland win.
Do you know that meme of the Terminator? I guess it's a kitchen, and there's like a little kid like hiding underneath the table. That will be you and I. I don't know how we're gonna figure it out, but that will be the template.
The way it looks right now is the teams are obviously in their set, but you know, Cuse has one good win, a great win over Virginia, and then kind of iffy everywhere else. Ohio State can get a Maryland win. That, you know, that changes everything in terms that puts them right in the conversation for an at-large spot. They don't need one quite yet. They don't, like, it's not a must win because they can still get to the Big Ten tournament and they can still try and win it. Or if they can maybe get a Rutgers win, that could also put them in that mix as well. But, yeah, it is a game of where, you know, how could the tournament picture change? This is one of them. If Ohio State could come away with this win, I think they're playing, as you mentioned, better on offense. I believe they are just a much better team in every way with Ryan Tarafenko on the field. And so I expect this to be a more competitive game than it was 16-8 the first go around. I think you've seen Ohio State over the last 3 weeks, 14-6 blowout win over Michigan on the road. You know, Michigan had been playing well coming in there, and Ohio State really kind of took it to them. I thought that was solid. That was an impressive win. They played Rutgers really close. And I think the Rutgers game is what they're going to try to replicate here. They're going to try and win a bunch of faceoffs.
Yes.
And they won a bunch of faceoffs against in that Rutgers game. In the Rutgers game, they won 76.1% adjusted faceoff wins against Maryland, 76% in that first meeting. Ohio State's going to win a lot of the faceoffs in these games. They're going to win a lot of faceoffs, and they're going to play, and they're going to grind the thing to a halt, and they're going to play really slow, and they're going to say, we cannot let Maryland get the ball. That's going to be that's kind of how every Big Ten team has tried to play Maryland this year, except for Rutgers, who, to get, you know, full hat tip to Rutgers. Rutgers tried to go to Maryland. They tried to play them. They didn't win, but, you know, the other Big Ten teams have mostly been like, how do we just avoid getting Maryland the ball? And we kind of criticized Ohio State for that in the first game, and I didn't like it as a strategy, and I still don't know if I do, but that's, I think, how they're going to play it, you know. And that's how every Big Ten team has been like, Maryland's weakness is probably they're not great on faceoffs. Let's try and win some faceoffs. Let's milk the clock, play it slow, keep the ball out of Jared Bernhardt and the rest of those guys' hands.
You're making a great point, and we love the razzle dazzle. You know, I love Chris Gray, I love Rutgers. You know, but don't say this is pejorative. Like, there really is something to be poised. Like the first go around, like, they got what they needed the first off. as you noted, like, no disrespect to Shockey and stuff like that. You know, Ohio State won 19 of 27 faceoffs. You know, pretty dominant effort, you know, three out of four, essentially. 18 turnovers. You can't, like, throw the ball away. And, you know, probably a lot of that has to do with Maryland. You know, it's been known as, you know, doing well with cost turnovers. I believe they these were all essentially self-inflicted. Maryland had four cost turnovers in the first game against Ohio State. So if you get what you need, the face-off, and the offense just can actually do its thing because it actually has the ball. But you can't, like, you know, have the, you know, self-inflicted wounds of these turnovers, especially if you're, you know, your whole point is, like, we need to control the pace of play, milk the clock, or, you know, be strike when we need to and stuff like that. But, like, you know, if you're throwing the ball all over the field, like, you know, it's just going to be a long day for your defense.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get it as a strategy. I don't know. I think if I got Jack Myers, Trey LeClair, Jackson Reed, Ryan Tarefanko, Griffin Hughes, I know Maryland's awesome, but I think I'd play it differently. But yeah, I get their strategy.
We always talk about Navlin. You're right. We always talk about Navlin. Like, when they do, you know, they choke you out. But, like, if they see, you know, they all have a green light if they, you know, have an advantage. You know, that kind of quick strike, that's what turns those 1 or 2 point leads into 3 or 4 point leads, and that really then kind of takes the air out of the other team. So you're right, you got to take your chances. Like, if you see an opportunity, just go, you know, and those transition points.
They'll be with Tarefanko. No, sorry to cut you off. With Tarefanko, they'll feel better in transition. I think they'll probably push it a bit more, but. Yeah, they're gonna try and sit on this thing, and if they can not turn it over as much and, you know, be relatively efficient in terms of their passing and their, you know, methodicalness, then, yeah, I could see a route to success. My thing, though, is that how much do you have to keep the ball out of Maryland's hands to prevent them from just scoring a bunch of, like, Hopkins had a bunch of success on Ohio State's defense. And Hopkins' offense ain't Maryland's. Mm-hmm. And Rutgers has had the second goal. Like, if Ohio State can play defense the way they did against Rutgers in that first game, then yeah, I think they're in this game. But that aside from, like, the Michigan game, they just have not really done that this year. I mean, first go around against Rutgers, 42%. Michigan, the first game that they won, 13-10, 33.5%. The first Maryland game, it was 39%. Like, even with Tarefanko back there last week, it still was not a great defensive performance. I don't think they've got the defense. And so even if you keep the ball, that was the story of the first game. Even if they kept the ball away from Maryland, it just, Jared Bernhardt had a quiet day. He had 5 points. But Logan Wisnowski has had a monster day. And then, you know, Maryland had got, I think, like, 5 points from its second line midfield in that game. They only got 5 points from its first midfield, and Bubba Fairman's playing a lot better than he was playing a month ago. Anthony DeMeo is playing better than he was playing. He had a big game against Michigan. Maryland's just even more imposing on offense now with Fairman, the way he's been playing, with 9 points in his last three games, 7 goals. Ohio State, I just do not think they have a good defense. I just do not see with them on defense. It's not an Ohio State defense that we're used to. They occasionally show some flashes, but by and large, at this point of the season, the majority of the evidence laid bare is that Ohio State is not a good defensive team. And if you're not a good defensive team against Maryland, I don't know how, even no matter how much you control the game and keep the ball away, they're still probably going to get enough possessions to score 12, 13, 14 goals. That's a bad game for them, you know? I mean, the fewest goals they've scored all year is 13. So even if you do that, then Ohio State has to play a great offensive game on Maryland's defense. Can they do it? If they get enough of the ball, maybe. Yeah. And if they can maybe get some transition with Tarefanko, or maybe if they're not turning the ball over the way they were in the first game, LeClair has a big game. I see the route to it for Ohio State. I don't see the execution. It would take Ohio State's best game, and it would take maybe the worst game Maryland's, maybe not the worst game Maryland's played this year, but in that conversation. And I don't see that happen.
Nah, tall orders, for the Buckeyes. But like you've been noting, they do eat on faceoffs. And oddly enough, the two games that had their worst adjusted offensive efficiency, the Maryland game, as you noted, and the Rutgers game from 2 weekends ago, the 26.9% and 25.7% respectively, were also the days that had the best face-off then, 75.6% and 76.1% respectively. So again, as always, all numbers, shout out to the cross reference. I hope you guys liked that pod. Moving on, Jake, I'm just going to do a quick recap of some of the games on Friday and some other just games on Saturday, and then we'll go to our second half where we talk about the, our other big stories of this week. So again, Friday, a little bit of a nice little pack of games. You have Binghamton at Stony Brook at 3, or at least for Friday night lacrosse purposes. Binghamton and Stony Brook at 3, Michigan at Penn State on Big Ten Network at 5, Lehigh at Lafayette at 7:30 p.m., and Robert Morris versus Bucknell at 7:30. That, at least kind of pretty anticipated Albany Vermont game got postponed. And kind of tackled most of the big games that we're interested in. We'll have an ESPNU game at noon. The Utes will travel and play Virginia. That's it for the ones that we, on Saturday, Delaware versus Hofstra, that's going to be an interesting one. 4 o'clock on Saturday. Definitely going to be, at least for us, right? I mean, BU Army, 2 o'clock. Going to be really interesting. We've kind of been impressed by Terriers. The offense, Army's definitely just been playing very well this year, and hopefully they continue on. And as we pointed out, Sunday, aside from Ohio State versus Maryland on Big Ten Network at 5, another TV game will be Lafayette at Lehigh at noon on Sunday on CBS Sports Network. So
and as we. Georgetown, Denver at 12 on Fox Sports 2.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, those are for Saturday, right? But yeah, nice weekend of games on the tube, Love to see it. Hopefully with the kickback, catch some of the action this weekend. So we're going to go to some of the other big stories that kind of really caught our attention.
I guess we'll just to pause. The Duke-Virginia hit halftime. 7-6 Blue Devils. Been a pretty competitive game so far. Virginia's getting, Charlie Bertrand's been the big guy for Virginia, so the Cavs are getting some depth of scoring, certainly in the early going. That's something that they lacked in the early portions of their season. So you're seeing some of the improvements of Virginia laid bare so far in this one. Duke's defense holding up pretty darn well so far. Virginia at 28.6% offensive efficiency. Virginia's defense not playing poorly by any means. I kind of felt, would Duke, Virginia have an answer for Sowers? And they kind of have, but what they haven't had an answer for is Brendan O'Neal. O'Neal's done a lot of dodging from up top, and he's had 2 assists off it. He's also had a shot from up top. Duke's kind of changed their maybe offensive initiation point, so we're seeing an adjustment from what they did on Saturday, where it was a lot of were kind of Sowers and his dodging from X got kind of shut down, and then you saw their sort of midfield dodges down the alley is sort of get clogged up. So now they've had O'Neal as an attackman dodging more from up top, kind of from the wing, and it's created some good opportunities from them. Robertson dodging from the wing, he's had 3 assists as well. Sowers has a goal, but it was off ball. I think he got a pass from O'Neal. So seeing the kind of adjustments Duke's made, and it's kind of gotten them the edge so far. I think they led 7-4 at one point. The Cavs have got the last 2 goals. Duke's still 9 turnovers, so kind of some sloppiness has plagued them a bit. Been a bit of a slower on the Duke's been playing a bit slower. Virginia's, running and gunning as you would expect from the Cavaliers. Also been a bit of a, how am I trying to say, kind of similar was it the, the Duke Cuse game, maybe, or the Virginia Notre Dame game. It's similar, a lot of penalties so far. Just been a bit of hard to get a sort of a flow to it. Both teams have kind of been, you know, going at each other, and so it's kind of led to some penalties. But competitive game certainly so far. Feels like Duke's had the carry of it, but Virginia's, you know, hanging in there, hanging around, and we'll see how. Virginia's had the advantage on the faceoffs, which is probably why they're, you know, hanging around a bit.
I was going to say let the kids play, but then I think the penalty at the end of the half was an unsportsmanlike conduct by Laviano. So.
Oh, yeah, Laviano dived, like, right into Adler in the crease.
Maybe the refs are just trying to keep a lid on things. But you know what? We can't take all the credit because the New Devils did most of the work. Perfect on clear, since we noted that they were over 2 to start the game, 10 of 12 for the first half. So that should be an exciting finish to, you know, seems to be a pretty competitive game. Yeah, I guess the second half show just kind of point to some of the stories that really caught our attention. Kind of unfortunate news. Holy Cross men's and women's college cross seasons have been canceled. Due to COVID violations. You can find this in a lot of publications. The one I'm reading off is U.S. Lacrosse Magazine by Matt Hamilton. Wednesday night, Holy Cross announced that the men and women's programs will cancel the remainder of the season due to a quote-unquote violation of team standards at the college COVID-19 health and safety protocols. The cancellation of the season is effective immediately. The men's team was slated to finish out this year with a matchup against BU on April 23rd, while the women... Our team was hosting its home finale against Lafayette on April 24th. So, yeah, you know, sad to see the, you know, with all due respect, the Crusaders are going to make a run for the tournament, you know, that they're even going to make the Patriot League. But it's still sad to see for players, you know, not being able to finish the season, as planned, and both the men and women's team, you know. As we always said, we always support prudent decisions by administration. So, you know, they got some COVID policies, and may appear that didn't adhere to those policies as closely as one should. These are potential consequences. So with that, delicately, David, I don't know if you had any thoughts on Holy Cross on the down. Grand opening, grand closing, right? They just tweeted out the day before, so really interesting plans for the athletic department, and the next day lacrosse is up there.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's as bad as this year, what these athletes have had to, I mean, I feel for them in some ways, you know, of the things they're being asked to do are things that not a lot of other people are being asked to do on either one in just the real world or in even some ways on college campuses. And that's, I guess you could say that is the price of admission for playing college sports and getting that opportunity. Yeah, that's fair. But all these athletes in some way or another are bringing something to, they're bringing something, some money in some form or fashion, even lacrosse, not even remotely close. I mean, it's a non-revenue sport. It's not even remotely close, obviously, to what football's bringing, but they're all bringing something. You know, they're all bringing attention to the school in some form or another. And not to get into a different point, but, you know, we know they don't get compensated for that. And so, you know, that they're having to adhere to, some, you know, really stringent kind of guidelines and expectations. That, again, other people, you know, in depending on the restrictions in each state, maybe don't have to, or even people in the university. I feel unfortunate in that regard. But ultimately, look, the rules are the rules. We don't know what it was that they did to break the protocols, but you break the protocols, and you can't do it. And everyone kind of knew what the game and what the situation was. Coming into this year, you had to be disciplined. You had to be smart. You had to follow, you know, what these protocols were. And I guess it's a lesson to be taken of, you know, hey, this is there are, you know, consequences to actions, you know, and that, sure, not every season's going to be a pandemic, but I think, you know, everyone's kind of talks about, like, athletes, you know, now college athletes know that, you know, a season can be taken away from you at any time because of COVID. And yeah, that's true because of, like, literally the virus itself, but also because of, you know, hey, if you don't do what's expected of you as a, as part of a team, then that can, also be taken away from you, even in potentially in normal times, you know, that these things maybe we don't see in normal times in the same way that, can still occur. So I hope that, you know, that's the lesson taken, even though, again, without really knowing all of, they didn't really tell us much here, just that they broke protocols and that's it. But I hope that lesson's taken, and hopefully, you know, it's a valued one and they come back better for it as a team next year.
Absolutely. As you know, we are the theme, you know, forgiveness and growth. So, you know, I know these kids probably feel horrible. Everybody associated with the team loved to close the season the way they planned, but didn't happen that way. So hopefully everyone just grows from the situation. And kind of also a story that we're kind of looking at. I mean, like, it's still, I guess, percolating is maybe the word. It's not directly impacting on the cross, but a very interesting article from the Connecticut Post report came out. The University of Hartford is considering a move to Division III athletics. This particular article I'm looking at is written by Michael Fornabio, again for the Connecticut Post. But it's kind of spiraling into, you know, we love talking about PR, we're big the Think of It fans, but it seems to be a little bit going a little bit of a disaster at Hartford. with respect, of course, because again, this article from NUC Connecticut by Gabrielle Lucavero, email exchange appears to show University of Hartford president soliciting support of move to Division III athletics. So obviously, when the announcement came out, there was a bit of a little backlash from alums and, you know, people associated with athletic programs. Our boy Chris has been right on this story, and that. Matter of fact, tweeted out some images from, I think, a feasibility study or an internal document that kind of showed some numbers of how Connecticut ranks among its peers in terms of major college rankings and stuff. And I think their belief is that a move to Division III would, you know, obviously be financially much beneficial for them, but also... I think maybe just change the culture a little bit and maybe hopefully increase their ranking. So, you know, definitely not part of the board and not the president of Woodward. But if you wouldn't mind, Jake, I'm just going to just read this quick little text message exchange again from the NBC Connecticut article that we mentioned earlier. So the exchange was accidentally shared over video chat during an online class and students took screenshots of it. Just real quick, Jake, I think you're going to co-sign on this. Everything is always on. All the time. Just imagine this on. Just like maybe shade, you know, people who shade their background or just like be an adult and just put down anything that you don't want other people to know. In the Zoom age, you know, the camera's always watching. So this is President Woodward talking to, I believe his name is, what's their name? Doesn't show, but Goldstein, I don't share his first name, but yeah, so Woodward to Goldstein, quote unquote, use your voice, write an editorial, get Senate and other FAR groups to pass resolutions or write letters to the current in support of the move. Goldstein, I thank you for this wonderful response, Greg. I don't know how much organizing I can do, but I would definitely write something, hopefully for the current. Warren is best if you just speak to the mission of the university and the disconnect that has grown over years between D1 sports and university mission. Be a faculty member with smart opinions on a more equitable experience for all your students, wellness, health, etc. It will be a part of the puzzle that needs to be said, and you can let me and the spin doctors do the numbers. So, you know, not something you kind of want out there to all your students joining the Zoom call. But I think, you know, something we've been talking about all year, especially kind of with the start of the shutdown last March and April, yeah, this was going to be extremely arduous financial time for a lot of universities, whether it's athletic budget or just, you know, just the operating budget. You know, they thought of things that they would get revenue from fees and tuition and summer classes and, you know, winter intermission classes and essentially having to prorate their tuition because students are like, why am I paying for a Zoom class and I'm going to Yale? So, yeah, it's just been a difficult time for everyone and, you know, kind of weren't happy about it. But I was like, you know, realistically, you know, we may see some schools make some what appear to be pretty dire decisions. And next, I think, 5-10 years is going to be kind of a very tumultuous time for higher education. You know, you saw some things like Furman canceling college lacrosse. There's the lacrosse team, but you know, it's like I said, it's, a lot of schools are really hurting and they're having these types of conversations. It's really odd, you know, for it to be on the public like this. And I'm sure embarrassing for all involved. So I do share some sympathy, but, you know, it is something that I think is going to just be more openly talked about, you know, so, and if, any media thoughts on this?
I'm just like laughing. Like the guy, the president or whatever was one, he starts off the article. It's like, yeah, we've been having these conversations. It's not exactly something, you know, we wanted to be talking about in public with you. And it's just like, it's like, well, buddy, you're talking about it now. but like, what exactly do you expect? Like he was like, we just made the NCAA tournament and we don't have any more money than we did before. It's like, yeah, dude, that's kind of how it works when you're the University of Hartford. Making one NCAA tournament does not like automatically make you flush with cash. Like,
yeah.
Were you under the impression that's how it worked? Like,
he's like, I read that Wall Street Journal article about some Johnny Manziel. Deborah, what's that name? Johnny Manziel football. He brought in a billion. What's going on here?
Like, no, that's not how it. The whole thing about being a president or an AD of a, you know, a school like Hartford and, you know, the America East, or it's, you know, D1 in sports without football, basically. Like, the money is not, you know. It's not going to be luxurious, you know. You have to. Someone put it in the chat to us. It's like, man, you got to like hustle a bit, you know. Like you got to, you as a university, if you want money to come in from D1 athletics, you got to hustle to build, you know, a brand here. You got to hustle to, you know, get your name out there. You got to hustle to get things for your school in terms of, you know, whether that be better TV or, you know, for the conference, or just better, you know, local media coverage, or you know, sponsorships, things like that. Like, these are all things you gotta, you know, just like hustle to do. It's not like you just make the NCAA tournament and all of a sudden you're flush with cash. And I felt like that was their assumption. That like, oh, we made the tournament and then, you know, we're gonna have money, and then that, you know, that money didn't come, and it's like, all right, well, I guess it's time to go to D3 or whatever. I mean,
what does he feel like, the Scarface team where they're bringing in double bags of cash after?
Exactly.
Like, all right, shut it down. Shut it down.
I was told there would be money here. Well,
they talk about the bag, man. I kind of imagining like this guy's like, you know, Hugh Abbott from the Thick of It. It's just like, his notions of, you know, maybe this is something that they were planning for a long time, and, you know, circumstances, pandemic.
Yeah,
stuff.
No, yeah. I feel like this has been a consideration that they've had, but it felt like, I just felt like a Michael Sowers with a Michael Sowers goal. That's good to see. It felt like they had it just felt like they didn't quite understand what, like, I'm sure this is a consideration they had, but I feel like it came from a place of they didn't, like, they were wondering why there wasn't more money coming in. And it's like, well, because if you don't have football, money doesn't just funnel in, you know?
Like, yeah.
Or if you don't have D1 football, I should, FBS football, I should say. I think, pretty sure Hartford, I believe, has FCS football, but FCS football and I don't D1 men's football. I'm not even talking freaking the same universe in terms of does Hartford do they have football? Let me look that up. Does Hartford have? No, actually, they're not a football. So yeah, even if you don't even have FB, if you don't even have FCS football, you're like really, you know, like FCS football. You know, at schools like Towson, Albany, some of these CAA schools, that's what allows them to be, you know, relatively more profitable and have successful athletic departments. You know, than their non-football school conference. If you don't have football at all, man, it is not going to be a money train. Like it's no. Just that. That's just not how it's going to go in any capacity. So if you want to be successful as a Pittsburgh, again, you gotta hustle. You gotta put more work in. And I feel like they didn't maybe understand the. And if you don't want to put that work in, I guess like fine. But I don't know if I feel like that decision. One, that decision could have been come to at another time besides 1 month after your team just made the NCAA tournament.
Yeah.
You know, like, that could talk about not exactly great for morale. I don't know. It's just.
Yeah, unfortunately, just spilled into the headline. Just real quick, from the article from NBC Connecticut. In the statement to NBC Connecticut, the university said the emails were an, quote-unquote, informal exchange that included, quote-unquote, a joking statement. and that the President Woodward regresses his chosen word. That's his bait. We know from Malcolm Tucker, you never want to use the word joking in your statement, because the immediate question is, when asked what he would say to a student who do not view this as a joking matter, the school replied with another statement. So have you ever got to make a statement on top of your statement?
Statement for the statement.
And again, that's a good joke, but I got it. This is a great opener. He fully recognizes the anxiety this discussion has raised, and will continue to reassure our student athletes of our commitment to them now and in the future. But that should have been the first one. You know, he never said joking in the first. So anyway, we'll keep our eye out on University of Hartford. You know, hopefully they find like an amicable resolution that, you know, at the very least, honors all the commitments, financial commitments to their present student athletes. And if they make the move, you know, we always say, you know, at the end of the day, some of these schools, they don't, not even fully funded, you know, they not to be totally cynical, but, you know, it's a financial decision to try to get 50, the college age males to pay full rate at their school. So if you can do that and not have to pay the D1 costs, you know, by doing it in D3, you know, you may see some more teams, as they say, embrace the amateuristic spirit of Division III lacrosse. So moving on to like more, you know, enjoyable, happy note, Jake, the first RPI of the 2021 season dropped. And let me tell you, it was a doozy. Shout out to, you know what, let me stop talking. Mike, do you want to write at least read out the first 10? And no, I'll can read out the next 10 or?
You can do it all. Yeah, sure. Let me pull this up. I just want to say, like, people kind of say it like all year long, like, hey, man, you know, you probably don't want to use RPI. And people are like, well, what else are you going to use? It's like, well, here's why you don't want to use RPI. Here is the team that is currently seventh in RPI, Marist.
And we love the Rare Foxes, but they played one game this year.
One game. Monmouth is 13th in RPI. No disrespect to Monmouth whatsoever, but, you know, still. Manhattan, who is 3-3, is 16th in RPI. Maryland is behind Marist in the RPI. Just letting you know. So, Virginia's first, by the way, Duke's second, Army's third, which is interesting. I don't think this is getting used. I don't. Like, how do you use it? Like, what am I supposed to, like, use it for one to be like, well, Virginia's one in it, so I guess we can seed Virginia two, but then Monmouth has a better RPI than Georgetown. So, like, we can't use it there, and Georgetown will get a at-large. It's like, you just can't use it. There's no use from this year. Like, there's just nothing. So, yeah, man, it's the eye test, and it's the coaches poll, and because coaches are on those kind of those regional advisory committees or whatever, so
basically, you'll love it.
The coaches poll, I think, is the way of looking at it. Whoever these coaches have as their best teams, it's who you beat among those teams, basically. You know, mm-hmm. So look at the coaches poll, and if you got wins over some of those top 10 teams, then yeah, I think that'll come into play in terms of your wins. They'll use polls in a way maybe they couldn't use them before, but yeah, like, Pat Stevens even said, he's like, the RPI was released, but how much can we gain from it? He's like, nothing.
Yeah.
There's nothing.
I know Hopkins haters are going to love to see it, but the Jays behind both NJIT and Wagner. The Highlanders are 54th in the country. Wagner 59th in the that scrappy Baltimore Johns Hopkins is 60th. So I'm all for scrappy now, okay? Okay, count me in. But at least we'll read out the first 10, 15, or at least the ones you find interesting. So let it rip.
Oh, I just said, but Virginia's won. Number two is Duke. What else we got here? Army 3, Carolina 4, Cuse 5, Lehigh 6, Marist 7, Maryland 8, Notre Dame 9, Rutgers 10, Denver 11, UMass 12, Monmouth 13, Drexel 14, Georgetown 15, Bubble Team Manhattan 16th. then you got a couple CAA teams, 23, 24, Richmond's 25. So
what's Ohio State? Were they 37?
Yeah, Ohio State's 37th. One spot ahead of Marquette, who's 1-7.
Hmm.
Or two and seven, I think. Maybe, yeah. They might have got a win over I don't know if they counted their win over St. John's, but yeah, either way, they're one spot ahead of a team who's won like one or two games.
Oh, no, you're reading it right. Maybe they haven't updated it, but yeah, they're definitely 1-7 on the page here. So, yeah, RPI is going. It is what it is. I think they're the first. If you just not ignore, no disrespect to Marist, but take out Marist and Monmouth. UMass is kind of had up and down. I don't know if they even in anybody's top 20 right now, but that first 8 or 9 is pretty. Seems to be pretty right, right. I don't see too much of an argument. You could probably say Maryland is way too low on this RPI, but that is implicit on this podcast. So just moving on, I don't know if you want the update on the score before go to some listener questions.
Oh, we got 11-9 Cavs. Big-time shot there from Doc Aiken. He's got a hat trick. He's having a big game. Virginia starting to kind of tilt the field a bit. Duke. Virginia is up to, at this point in terms of the face-offs, a 60-40 face-off win rate. But Duke's at 3 fail clears. 13 turnovers now for the Blue Devils. The sloppiness has kind of carried over and continued for them. Well, they've had the ball on offense. They've done pretty well, but... kind of as I mentioned, if Virginia could win the faceoffs and if Virginia could force some turnovers and kind of create that havoc, then I think that would be their ticket to, maybe coming out on top. And as it stands, that's been the key. Duke, just a general, even on offense, just a general kind of sloppiness that you don't really expect from a John Donowski team, or maybe you expect early on in the season, but certainly now when we get to the middle of April. And so that kind of, that's what's been hurting them. But Virginia played a pretty clean game. Only 5 turnovers, only 1 fail clear, and 13-21 on the draws has given the Cavs the edge so far.
Absolutely. Looks like what? Little under 3 minutes?
Yep. Duke ball with about 2.5 minutes to go, rather, in Q3.
Definitely. Moving on to kind of fun listener question. Shout out to King Street Linden. Jake, if you had the opportunity, would you rather be the offensive coordinator at Duke or Maryland?
Well, one, can I just want to mention here, before the season, as Sowers with a tremendous roll dodge inside to score, make it a one goal game. Before the season, I asked, would you rather have Maryland's top six offensive guys, or Maryland's offense, or Duke's? And I put it out a poll on the account, and it was pretty much like Duke went with like 75%. And now I would just like to mention that Maryland's got the better offense than Duke. That's all. Just wanted to say that. Just wanted to put that out there. I was saying in like, you know, when Bernhardt came back, then Maryland had a top three offense in the country, probably better than Duke, and no one wanted to listen. So anyhow, to answer the question, I think it goes back to why I thought Maryland had the better offense. I'd rather be the offensive coordinator in Maryland because all these guys have played together for years. Like, I think that's Duke's. Michael Sowers has played with these guys for a couple months. Brennan O'Neill has played with these guys for a couple months. You've got Aiden Denenza in there who's played, coming in future with them. But like Joe Robertson, for example, Joe Robertson missed all of last year. So he's playing with Owen Caputo Owen Caputo is a junior, but he really broke out last year in terms of his feature. He didn't play as much with Joe Robertson in 2019. Same with Dyson Williams, who was a freshman last year. So even Duke's more experienced guys haven't necessarily played with each other. The only guys you've got who have really had a full season playing together is Joe Robertson and Akai Montgomery. Like, they're the guys who have had the experience in terms of playing together and have that kind of familiarity and cohesion. And, I figured it'd be something that would kind of work itself out as the season went on. And I still think it's still a work in progress for them. Doesn't mean they won't figure it out, but it's still something that I don't quite think they've completely figured out yet. And I think they've maybe felt like they did figure it out. But then ACC play came, and it's the competition ratcheted up, it got tougher, and I think they're gonna have to make some adjustments once again, and Dano's the guy to do that, certainly. But I just think that's kind of my, I think they haven't quite figured it out yet to this point. And look, they're still awesome. They're fifth in the country in adjusted offensive efficiency, so they're great. Like, don't get me wrong here. You have that talent. That talent's gonna win out most of the time, and it has. But you transition that to Maryland's offense. Jared Bernhardt and Luke Wisnowsis have played together for two full seasons, and now going on, four seasons in total. Jared Bernhardt and Daniel Maltz have played together they played together some last year. Maltz is a freshman. Kyle Long, Jared Bernhardt, Luke Wisnowsis played together since 2019. Anthony DeMayo's been there since 2018. Bubba Fairman's been there since 2018. These guys have played together a bunch. Like, they are completely familiar with each other. There's no... Maltz is the closest thing to a kind of new guy, and he still played with him last year, even in that, shortened season. And I think that's why you've seen, Bobby Benson come in, and I think he's made some tweaks and some fine-tuning that I think have been really beneficial to Maryland's offense and really helped him a lot. But in essence, a lot of these guys, like, Jared Bernhardt's been playing college lacrosse for 5 years now. Logan Wisnowsis has been in college lacrosse for 5 years now. These guys, to some degree, can coach. They know what they're doing. They run their offense. It's been the same offense forever. They have played together forever. They know what they're doing. And that's why I think I'd rather coach Maryland's, is because I can, and not just, you're not necessarily rolling the ball out there and playing, but it's like, hey, dudes, we do. You guys know how each other operate. You guys know, your each other's tendencies and what you guys do best. Have at it. While with Duke, I think, as you're seeing here, they might be figuring it out all the way to May, and they may get it right in May, and they may find the right formula in May and go on to win the national championship. That's certainly a complete possibility, but I think that's something they're going to be working with. Well, Maryland is, it's, you know, add in tweaks, and it's what can we improve on from last week to this week? What new wrinkle can we add in that maybe can make us better? It's not, you know, how do we fit together? We know how we fit together. We played together for our entire careers.
And I think, like, yeah, I mean, if you're looking at this season alone, you're absolutely right. More well-formed, comfortable with each other group with Terps. And again, if you, and then if you do, like, you know, 5,000-foot view, I think at the end of the day, like, Maryland is just such a rich state. You know what I mean? Like, it just makes more sense. Like, you know, offensive coordinator Maryland is going to have to pick up the litter.
The 5,000, I don't know, the way Danowski is recruiting right now. Jesus.
I'll respect the day. But you know what I'm saying? Like, there's some kid in, you know, Reisterstown, you know, with six kills that, like, you know.
In terms of the talent and the talent that's being brought in, Danowski's brought in the number one recruit last year, the number one recruit next year, a midfielder. And the number two recruit too, but he's a defender. In terms of the offensive talent that's being accumulated by Dano in recent years, it's pretty darn insane. He's just racking up dude after dude after dude. So is North Carolina though. North Carolina's recruiting class this year has 5 of the top 14 recruits in the country. It's ridiculous. They're bringing in just a boatload of dudes. For the Tar Heels, kind of some of those classes they put together when Bresci first got there. No, I mean, like, ultimately Maryland brings in, like, a crap ton of talent too. So, you know, like, it's your, I don't know if the... Ooh, they gave that goal to UVA. I thought he won the crease. So I think that might wash itself out, but... I mean, Dano, with those Long Island connections for Dano, they are paying fruit in the last couple of years.
Just a golden god. I love that picture you shared.
I should have shared that out with on our Twitter. I found it. It's 1990... Or 91, Hofstra went to the Dome to play Q's. It's young Dano. Oh, my goodness. Oh. Got the stash and everything.
Like a golden god. If they went tonight, that you may have to put that out there. Yeah. But, kind of agree. You can't go wrong with either position. I think that's our point. But, yeah, Dano's definitely just, you know, with such a long career, it seems like he's still, like, going, you know, upwards. You know what I mean? Like, you know, still, he's not winning national titles every single year, but just, you know, just has been a dominant run for so long. You know, that's the almost 14-year run at Duke.
With the talent they're accumulating, it does feel like they're in line for another one of those, you know, another national title soon. It certainly feels like they're in. It's been, what, 7 years since they've won one? I don't know if it's coming this year, but it does feel like the way they've been recruiting lately, certainly at a maybe – all the top schools are – Maryland's recruiting great right now. Duke's recruiting great. Carolina's recruiting great. You know, the Ivies were recruiting great. We'll see how COVID affects it, but you certainly had Yale recruiting really well. Cornell, too. Cuse was falling a bit behind, but even they've got a big class coming in the next, you know, year or two with Joey Spallina and then like Billy Dwan, Matt Dwan's kid. So they're certainly, you know, they're kind of peaking, they're perking themselves back as well. Notre Dame's got some big time guns coming in, Virginia too. So yeah, all the guys are all the, you know, notorious people, teams you'd expect to be recruiting great are recruiting great, but Duke maybe even just a cut above, just a teeny bit, with O'Neal, obviously, and then some of the guys they've got coming in, you know, next year, Dyson Williams from last year as well. They've been on a big run here that, yeah, you'd certainly anticipate that after, you know, a couple of years there where they didn't make a Final Four and, you know, weren't at the Duke level, that they're getting back to that now and will be having a good couple bites at the apple in terms of adding some more titles to their cabinet.
It is scary to think, like, after, no, not trying to say he's ancient, but, like, after such a long and storied career at Duke, it seems like he's, you know, reaching a new zenith. This class is that they're coming through, you know, pledging their potential. So, and just a testament.
Yeah,
to,
he's got plenty left in the tank. He's what, 60? What's down? 67? But yeah, no.
Good. No, looks good.
It does, yeah. But yeah, no sign. Looks good. Feeling good, obviously. No signs of slowing down at all.
Reminds me of a blonde Tom Selleck. I feel like. Yeah. Yeah, he's a tall, yeah, commanding presence. Shout out to Dana. But a little bit behind the eight ball here against Virginia. Right around 12 to play. So down two. But I don't know if any closing thoughts. I mean, we can definitely talk a little bit after we record. I just don't know if you wanted anything to share. We kind of went through all the big games and big stories that we were interested in this week.
Big games, and it's going to be cool to have some. We got what, Georgetown, Denver at 12 on Fox Sports 2, and you can jump into Cuse, Carolina at 3. And then you've got Sunday, you've got Maryland, Ohio State at 5. So don't even necessarily have to pull up the computer for the big games this week. You can, for everyone who still likes to just put it on the TV, that's readily available for you this week. This is maybe one of the better weeks we'll have till, obviously, you know, the conference tournament and then NCAA tournament, the weeks that everyone loves. This will be maybe one of the better ones or the best one till that comes around in a couple weeks.
Absolutely. And as always, you can find the main account at @college_cross. My Twitter handle is @Erie_Barrister. Jake, where can the good people find you?
You can find me @Jake_Nazar.
Excellent. And from all of us at College Cross, to all of you, enjoy the games this weekend, and it should be a good time. Talk to you guys later.
Stay hydrated. Becky Lynch for president.